Let's talk. I've got good news for you.
What the hell?
Hello and welcome to the special premium podcast of the Lotus Eaters. I'm your host, Harry, joined today by Josh.
Hello.
And we're going to be answering the question, why should you watch Twin Peaks? Because I wholeheartedly believe that it's a very rewarding show to watch and that you should give it a go, even if it's maybe not to your tastes at first, because there's a lot to dig into and a lot to enjoy about it and a lot to consider with the show. And I think you're on my same page here. We've both gone through rewatches of it recently. Mm-hmm. And this is a minor passion project of mine. It's a minor obsession of mine because I love the show. You've probably noticed me on podcasts and other shows talking about how much I love David Lynch's work, how much I love this particular TV show. Ever since I watched it for the first time 4 or 5 years ago, it's always been constantly on my mind because of the mysteries the show throws at you constantly and sets up, and the way that you can interpret the different imagery and actions of characters. It really sticks with you once you've finished it. And so I'm really glad to be doing this right now.
It's going to be good fun, I think.
Yes. Damn fine. And so to start off with, I think we should try and address that question straight away, because there will be spoilers, certainly as we go further into the video. We are going to be, appropriately for a show that's centered around and obsessed with mystery, mm-hmm. and sets up so many mysteries, we're going to be asking a series of questions and trying to answer them as best we can.
But I think we're going to be tackling the plot towards the end. So if you haven't watched Twin Peaks yet and you're still waiting to be convinced, mm-hmm. we're going to be talking about why it's good.
Yes.
Before we get onto that, and we'll give you a heads up if there are any spoilers.
Yeah, this first section, we're going to try and avoid being throwing too many spoilers out. And then as we go on into the plot, that's when we'll start to talk about the spoilers. And with that as well, the themes of the show, which are mm-hmm. more specific to some of the scenes in it, which we'll have to discuss the details of. So let's start with you, Josh. Why would you recommend somebody to watch Twin Peaks?
Well, when I first started watching it, I heard about the hype. Quite a few of my friends had started watching it, and I didn't really get it at first. And I thought, oh, okay, people are watching this because it's, you know, early 90s. It's kind of a callback. It's kind of this hipstery thing of, oh, look at this quaint 90s show. And then I started watching a bit more and a bit more. And then all of a sudden, I was just like, I get it.
It clicks for you, doesn't it?
It does. It's like putting on an old pair of boots that just fit right. That's but yeah, I think that it starts off, you think, okay, this is a cut and dry murder mystery. You know, I've seen hundreds of these before. You know, it's a very commonly used trope. And then all of a sudden, more and more things start creeping in. Mm. And you get these sort of almost television, daytime TV drama storylines, but not in the way that you know of them, in a sense. And it's done in a sort of quirky way where people actually seem to have their own personalities. They're not just an extension of the writer's will to move a plot. And there are so many quirks, and it seems like as you continue watching, rather than it being a petty drama, it feels like it's actually capturing an element of human life, I suppose.
Yes, I agree. And with that, it's good to talk about the fact that David Lynch is very well known, mainly as a surrealist filmmaker. He's made a few more straightforward films like The Elephant Man. I don't know if you could call Dune straightforward, but for him, it's more straightforward. And particularly The Straight Story, which the title says it all. But he's mainly known for his surrealist paintings, his surrealist films, his surrealist television shows and shorts that he put up on his website back in the day. But the thing is that I find that the way he uses surrealism, like you say, is basically to accentuate and highlight some of the strangeness that occurs in everyday life. One of the things that he and the co-creator, Mark Frost, when talking about the show, is not to be dismissed. He is one half of the primary creative team. He is the driving force behind most of the supernatural lore of the show, because it's not much of a spoiler to say that this show is definitely supernatural. when you look at Lynch's other works, you could say there are supernatural elements to it, but mostly it seems that most of his films exist within a dream reality or dreamscape of the characters themselves, where it's interpretive imagery meant to show their mindset. This is very definitively a supernatural mystery show.
Well, yeah, this show was the show that inspired The X-Files, as far as I'm aware. At least that's what I've been told.
A lot of things. And I think the inspiration and influence that this show has had is overstated in some ways and understated in others. I think some people overstate it as though it created prestige television. There had been film directors involved with television before and after Twin Peaks. There had been longer storylines on television throughout before Twin Peaks, like in the soap operas, which the first two series were kind of emulating, commenting on, and some would say satirizing.
Yeah, there's an element of satire there.
But the influence of Twin Peaks is more in the approach it took to the storytelling and the tone and storytelling techniques that it used. This was the first time, outside of maybe The Prisoner, where surrealist filmmaking was brought with a decent enough budget to television. And once again, what makes this so interesting for me is this is a supernatural plot told through the eyes of a very talented surrealist filmmaker. And the way that he creates the supernatural using filmic techniques, like the most notorious one would probably be the use of backwards talk in some of the supernatural areas that the show takes place in, creates a feeling unlike any other supernatural show or film that I've ever experienced, and really helps to highlight and give that feeling of otherworldliness, of the peculiar, the perplexing, and the alien. These creatures that the characters are interacting with are truly outside of the realm of human understanding. They're playing 4D chess with one another, where the human characters cannot truly comprehend what kind of mess they've got themselves into by interacting with these beings. But in most shows that try and tackle that kind of cosmic horror, almost that Lovecraftian horror, they do it in very standard ways. They do it in the, ooh, here's something spooky, here's something in the dark, here's something where you can't really understand it because we're not giving you enough information. There's parts of that. But the way that it's depicted in this is far more effective than anything else I've seen.
No, it very much so. And I think it's got its very own sort of approach to it that I've not really seen elsewhere other than in other David Lynch work, I think. And I think that the way they go about it, they're not trying to be scary. It's not like there's no elements of horror, really.
I would disagree there. There's definitely horror elements to the show. And
to the level of like a horror movie. There's certainly things that are meant to make you afraid, but it's not necessarily elements of, you know, conventional building blocks of, say, a horror plot. But it makes you unsettled, is the point I'm trying to make. It's meant to be unnerving. There's a sort of uncanny valley where things resemble reality in a way that you think you understand it, but then it gets twisted in a way in which you might not initially be able to comprehend. But also it's done quite well in that these changes to how you would perceive the world are sort of rule-based, and eventually you can figure things out. And I think one good thing that is done is that you can, just by paying attention to the show, figure out some of the rules rather than actually just being explicitly told. And I think that there is still a certain amount of characters explaining the plot to one another when they're figuring it out, but there are still things that you, the audience, have to put together yourself, which I quite like. And that also means that the uncertainty, the unfamiliarity, all of a sudden takes on a sort of personal element, because you've got to put the pieces together. It's not going to necessarily be done for you in all cases, and so you almost feel a bit invested in trying to solve these mysteries, just as the characters you're following do. And I think that that's just a sign of good filmmaking, although it's a TV show.
But and good writing as well. You're absolutely right there that it's a mystery show that, in the same way that, say, a Sherlock Holmes story would expect you to follow the clues and be able to figure them out, perhaps before Sherlock Holmes does, you're in a race with the characters. Twin Peaks draws you into the mystery and presents you with enough of the pieces to be able to put some solutions together. Some people think that there is an overarching answer to the entire show. I don't think that thematically that there is an overarching theme that really cements down a meaning to every single scene in the whole show. But I think in terms of the narrative pieces, you are given enough that you're able to figure out a lot of what's going on in a way that's really engaging, in a way that expects a certain level of intelligence from the audience. And like you say, there are expository scenes, but they are the characters figuring out along with the audience. The characters who deliver that exposition are often in the position of the audience when they've been confronted with something completely bizarre and unknowable, and they're taking the information that they know and trying to explain it. And when there are bits of the plot that are necessary for you to be able to start putting the pieces together properly, the show isn't afraid to just have somebody explain it to you, particularly in the film Fire Walk With Me, which kind of acts as an interlude extended episode of the show transitioning from the second to the third series. There are bits near the beginning of that where you have Kiefer Sutherland's character outright asking, what does this mean, to one character? And he just says, well, here's what this means. But then when you get to the bits that are very important to keep the mystery going, and he asks a question, the guy says, well, I can't tell you that right now. And it makes sense within the context of the plot, but it really helps to pull you as the audience along and highlight the things that you should be paying attention to and throwing aside the bits that aren't as relevant to the overall mm-hmm. story.
It is also worth mentioning as well that the mystery element sometimes in a show, in an effort to bring everyone along with it, it makes the mystery so easy as to be a bit dull. But there were situations in my first watch of Twin Peaks whereby a character would have figured something out and would be explaining it, and I had all the pieces to do that myself and was like, oh, that's how it all fits together.
Yes.
And that happens a few times actually, and that's really quite exciting to have that in a show, because normally I'm, you know, watching a film, because they're formulaic, because they're for quite often the lowest common denominator, they make it very accessible, and therefore it's not necessarily particularly mentally stimulating to try and figure it out. But in this show, there's a fair amount of that as you're going along, and it keeps you invested in what could otherwise be sometimes a slow building show,
especially in the third series. The third series opens in a very, very slow way, where all of the scenes that you're being presented seem like they're completely disconnected from another, telling completely different stories that could never overlap with one another. But then by the time you get to the end of the show, at least the end of part 17, because series 3 is an 18 part extended film, really, that's more structured like a novel than a typical television show, you see that all of those early building blocks were the foundations the rest of the show of that series has been built on. And a lot of it is quite straightforward and makes sense if you're willing to put in the time to be able to see how they all fit together yourself. And with the mystery aspect of it as well, I think sometimes people accuse Lynch and Frost of approaching it with a bit of a gung-ho attitude, where they were just making stuff up as they went along. The central mystery of the show to begin with is who killed Laura Palmer. Laura Palmer being the prom queen, the hometown girl right behind me, beautiful young woman played brilliantly by Cheryl Lee, who has turned up murdered, dead, wrapped in plastic. And the entire town is shocked by this. Everybody in the town seemed to love her, but she had this darker side to her that a lot of people knew about but were keeping to themselves. And the show is following that mystery. The show's producers, the television network, halfway through the second series, forced them to reveal the killer much earlier than they would like. Some interviews contradict and say that Lynch and Frost would never have revealed it if they'd had their way. I disagree with that, if only because Mark Frost, more than Lynch, seems to be a man who wants to provide some definitive answers to the mysteries of the show while leaving a lot of the threads open. That's what this book here, Twin Peaks, The Final Dossier, which was released right after the end of the third series, does. It leaves the primary mysteries of what's going on in the town open, but closes the threads on a few of those parts of the mystery which weren't as important, but they both help to understand what's going on and provide more questions to try and consider what is happening, and if there are different timelines going on and other such things. But I think that Mark Frost probably would have had it at the very least that in the last episode of the original planned series that you would have realized who the killer was. But some people accuse them of never having intended for there to be a killer in the first place, or at least a knowable killer, that they just went in, Laura Palmer is dead, we'll figure out who killed her later. I completely disagree with that. Even in the first series, if you follow the clues that are presented, I think it's pretty clear, once you've been through a watch of the show, at least those first two series, and you already know who the killer is, it's pretty clear who they're pointing towards, even if they're not making it too explicit. And in the second series, they just reveal it. Also, interesting factoid is that the television network that forced them to do it, one, turned Lynch off television for ages. He basically left the show for a little bit because he was that dejected that the whole golden goose of the show, he considered Laura Palmer's murder and the mystery surrounding that to be the framework that the rest of the stories of this town could be hung off of, basically the gravitational pull that the rest of it has satellite stories around, because what he really cared about was the characters in the town and the humanity that each of them presented and what they're going through, how her death affected them, etc., etc. The person who forced them to do that, which then tanked the show, tanked Lynch's involvement in it until the last episode of the second series, and forced Mark Frost to basically pull a load of stuff out so that he would be able to keep the show going until that point, was Bob Iger of Disney fame, who, like many within the media and entertainment industry, has a terrible track record of making the wrong decision over and over and over again, as far as I'm aware of the things that he does, but keeps getting promoted.
Mm-hmm.
Funny how that happens.
I'm certainly no fan of Bob Iger, but I think actually the decision to reveal the killer was quite at the time they did, and I'm not going to say who or when or what.
Not yet.
I thought that it was quite an interesting place for it, in that normally you would expect it to be at the end of a series, and it wasn't. And so when it happened, I was very surprised the first time I watched it, and I thought, hang on a minute, there are a bunch of other episodes here. This is... So actually,
we're barely even halfway through the second series. What's going to go on?
Well, I wasn't going to say where it happens, but it sort of sunk another hook in me, and I was like, well, I'm even more invested now. Because I think there's only so long people can go on being concerned with a mystery before they feel like they're getting strung along.
Mm.
And I think that actually it worked quite well, revealing it when they did, because by that point, you've also got lots of other questions. You're emotionally invested in lots of the characters. And one of the things that I found was that I almost craved myself wanting to just watch the ordinary daily life of the characters that I'd come to enjoy watching.
Mm.
And I was just like, well, I almost don't care if there's anything going on. I just want to see what's going on with these people now, which is obviously a sign of a well-written show. And I don't think there are too many points in the show where I lost interest in a plot line.
Mm.
There are one or two cases which we'll discuss later, but most of the time it gets you invested, and there are these sort of bait and switch things where the murder of Laura Palmer is the main mystery, but then there are all these other mysteries, and eventually, you know, when you get further along following the reveal of the killer and that sort of thing, you're already invested in so many other mysteries that it almost seems inconsequential now. Not in a bad sense, but just that it's like, well, I've got so many other questions, this one's finally being answered, but I want to look at the other stuff.
Absolutely. I think Lynch's big problem with it was that he and Frost were correct that at the time, revealing the killer too early, earlier than they intended, was really detrimental to the viewership of the show, and is what ended up getting it cancelled in the first place. Because after people had that itch scratched by revealing the killer, the viewership dropped off a cliff.
Well, maybe I'm a weirdo then for not being put off.
The thing is, I do agree with you that in the long run, I think it works to the benefit of the show, because by the point that they reveal the killer, they'd already started to really drop hints about the supernatural elements of the show. There'd already been hints of that in the first series, but the first series actually, apart from one or two bits, works very well as a tight thriller mystery where this new character, Dale Cooper, is coming into the town. He's investigating that, but as part of that, he finds a lot of connections to the dirty criminal underworld of Twin Peaks, which borders Canada because it's right in the north end of Washington, and finding that there's all these connections between criminal enterprises in the town, further up north with the crime families and such. And it really works as that self-contained mystery for that first series. But then the second series, you start to get much more, even before the killer is revealed, exposition and lore about what's going on behind the scenes and the supernatural parts of it. So they'd done the groundwork for that. And then the second half of the show, I think it's a mark on the quality of what Mark Frost was able to do without Lynch and using his writing staff around him, was that they were able to expand on those supernatural elements and start to build up a new and interesting mystery, which by the time you get to Lynch returning for the second series finale, has really built momentum again. You're really invested again. But there are a few rough episodes here and there. Not necessarily rough episodes. I think that's an unfair way of putting it. I wouldn't say there's a bad episode in the whole show, but there's a few rough storylines here and there. But some of those transitionary storylines I actually think are really entertaining in their own right, particularly a certain character, shall we say, play acting a revisionist history of the Civil War in the US, mm-hmm. Which is very, very entertaining for the whole run of it. They're able to build up the new mystery, but you are right. One of the best things about this show is, despite the mystery, despite the supernatural, despite the occasionally oppressive atmosphere and horror sequences, like you say, it's not a horror show, but there are definitely heavy horror elements to parts of it, I would say. Despite those parts, the thing that really keeps you coming back is that the characters that Frost and Lynch have set up and the rest of the writers have expanded on have such a great level of humanity and are so relatable in many ways, and the goings on in their life is so interesting. And the interactions between them, that's what keeps you hooked. For a show where people do highlight the weirdness of it, it's those down-to-earth moments and interactions between, for instance, one of my favorite things about the show, and this isn't too much of a spoiler there, is in early in the second series, an interaction between the character behind you, not the big grimacing man, Leyland Palmer, but Major Briggs and his son, Bobby. There is a beautiful and wonderful moment where these two people who have been very disconnected from one another. There's a big rift between them. Major Briggs is a military man. Bobby's kind of a drifter who's fallen in with the wrong crowd, making bad choices. Where the two of them sit down, decompress, and Briggs shares a beautiful dream with him that for the rest of the story really starts to mark a shift in Bobby. And that scene always gets a bit of a tear out of me, if I'm perfectly honest. And there are a few scenes in this show, particularly related to family matters, and the importance of family, because there's a lot in the show about abusive families, absent families, neglectful families. But when they go to look at the stories of families that are strong together and care about one another and the love that exists between them, it's some of the most touching and effective filmmaking and writing I've ever experienced. It's very, very difficult to get me to well up watching anything, kind of like a robot like that. This show can penetrate my armor, which is remarkable as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and I think that actually they get lots of human touches to relationships between people that make it almost like wrapping yourself in a warm blanket on a cold winter's day with a hot mug of coffee, let's just say. You know, it just is wholesome in cases. You know, obviously there is evil in the show. It's not sickly. There's a sort of there's a sweet and savory thing going on here.
I think there's a very definitive morality in the show, which is there is good and there is evil. There is black and there is white. There is some gray area, but that is generally where the good characters have been infected by the supernatural evil of the show, which happens every so often. And there's some gray area in the film, especially because the film is kind of its own beast and genuinely a difficult watch in places. And that's not because it's poor quality. It's incredibly high quality. The film is one of my favorites of all time, but it's not one that you'll be going back to on repeat because it's genuinely difficult, some of the subject matter that it touches on.
But just to quickly add on what you're going to say there, because there are the elements
of the coffee.
Of course.
Thank you.
Because there are these shifts between very wholesome family scenes, people getting along, people forming new relationships, everything going quite smoothly and written in a way which is investing. When the bad stuff happens, it makes it, you feel the emotions that the characters are feeling. You feel what they're going through because you know that they've had these wonderful moments, and therefore to have these terrible things happen to them is all the more tragic, I think. They sort of feed into one another. The bad makes the good better, and the good makes the bad better from the sort of cinematic perspective.
And on that, there's a definite theme of duality and balance that goes throughout it. One of the most memorable characters in the show, who's been referenced in all sorts of media. Also, this coffee tastes kind of like donuts, and I don't know what's going on there, if it's just I've been looking at those donuts and they look very tasty and it's infected my mind in some way, but this coffee tastes a little bit too much like donuts for my liking. I'm a bit suspicious. One of the most memeable characters in the whole show and memorable ones is the Log Lady. In the 1995 European reruns of the show, I think, Lynch went and filmed what's now known as the Log Lady intros, which are included in any DVD or Blu-ray version of the show that you might get. And that's basically Lynch using the character of the Log Lady, who, rest in peace, was played by Margaret Coulson, who'd been working with him ever since Eraserhead, his first feature film that he'd done. Is using her to talk through it. And one of them that's very impactful, these little 30-second monologues, is where she's talking about balance and the need for balance, and anything that throws off the balance of life is a destructive and chaotic force. And that feeling of duality is made very explicit in the show through some characters literally having a good and a dark side, and the two of them having to metaphorically come together to create something that is more balanced. Lynch has this theme running throughout most of his work of the idea that what's good in life is only made possible because of the bad that's in life. The only reason we're able to understand and appreciate what's wholesome, what's necessary, what's primal to us, like the loving relationship of a family, is because it can be contrasted against the darkness that which is natural to the world. And it is very clear in the show that the darkness and the evil that exists is a natural being. It's something that comes from the air, from the woods. It's something that's inherent in life itself. And it's basically only through human efforts and human goodness and kindness and a melding of intuition and rationality, of instinct and rationality that comes into a balance to create intuition, that we can really start to carve out a place in the world that could be considered good.
No, I wholeheartedly agree. And I think that's one of the central themes of the whole show, really. And it's interesting as well, because I suppose we may as well touch on the morality of the show and some of the things like that, because that seems like the natural direction. Because there are some situations where things do seem morally grey, and on some occasions you think, oh, well, I'm not sure you should be doing that. And sometimes you're like, oh, you need to go further. And it does a good job of not being too moralizing at the same time. Sometimes someone doing something bad does work out. Sometimes someone doing something good goes wrong. And there's enough of that variation, but there's still a sort of good balance, if dare I say, of goodness being rewarded and badness being punished. So there seems like a very loose element of cosmic justice going on in the film, which I find interesting when there's a central theme of morality involved. Because if it were too chaotic, if there was no relationship between good and bad and the just desserts, if you will, it wouldn't be as investing. You wouldn't be as invested in the plot line, because it almost seems like it's inconsequential to the people's actions what happens to them. But there's enough randomness, as there is in life, that it keeps you second guessing. You think it's likely that someone doing something bad might come to regret it, but it's not necessarily inevitable. And I think that that's also good. It respects the audience to a certain extent, not ham-fistedly shoving morality down your throat, even though it's something that's clearly a central part of Twin Peaks.
Yeah, it's certainly not, the same way it doesn't spoon-feed you the answers to the mysteries, it doesn't spoon-feed you the morality that you should be expecting. Even at the very end of the show, which in itself, that the very last scene of it, acts as a mystery all unto itself, to the point where there is still a minor cottage industry on YouTube of people trying to figure out either what it all means or what actually happened. Because the narrative, especially in the third series, does become very complex and very ambiguous as to what's going on by the end. But the morality of it is clear, that the particular character it's all centered around is trying to do something good. And depending on your perspective of the narrative plot threads that led to that point and what you think is going on, his intention to do good may have worked out and defeated what could be considered an ultimate evil, or it could be something that, and this is without spoiling the actual narrative plot threads that lead there, or it could be something more grey than that. It could be a loop. It could be something where evil won out. These are all questions that we as the viewers are expected to answer. And Lynch and Frost are both very hesitant, as always, to answer any of these questions for you. I think Lynch is, for all of his films and television, of the opinion that if I were going to answer the question for you, I wouldn't have presented it as a mystery. You as an individual watching and absorbing and feeling through the show and his films get more from being able to come to your own conclusions about what it all meant than anything that I could ever do for you. Plus, it does ruin the mystery. If you are left wondering what happened, that keeps it in your mind forever. That means that it's something that sticks for you. Whereas if you then just look up an interview with the creator who tells you explicitly what it meant, oh, here's exactly what everything was supposed to be, well, it's done. You never have to think about it again unless you go, what was all that about? Oh yeah, David Lynch said it was about this. It would be pointless to even present the mysteries in the first place. This is something that I love 2001, A Space Odyssey, and I love Stanley Kubrick's filmmaking, but Stanley Kubrick went on record in phone interviews and radio stations explaining what the ending was about, when the ending, as presented in the film, is really ambiguous and leaves you wondering what's going to happen, what was going on, which is much more meaningful and impactful than just being able to go on YouTube and find an interview of Stanley Kubrick saying, well, the main character, Dave, he ends up in basically an observation room overlooked by aliens who are trying to present him with some facsimile of life that he might understand to keep him comfortable so they can study him and then evolve him into a star child, and he heads back to the Earth to evolve the rest of life on Earth. Well, okay, I was much more invested when I didn't know all that. Mm-hmm. But I feel like Kubrick felt the need to explain it because so many people asked him, and he was expecting them to figure it out themselves.
There's also the novel from Arthur C. Clarke as well, yeah, which fills in a lot of the spaces that Kubrick left out. But I mean, 2001: A Space Odyssey is my favorite film, so I'm not going to.
It's still a classic. Not going to criticize it. And to be fair, that last sequence in 2001 feels like it must have left a mark on Lynch, especially in the weird time hazy editing of it, where he's looking over, sees himself in the future, then it cuts and you're in that perspective of him as the future, and that's how time is progressing. I think that's very clearly an influence on filmmakers like Lynch and anybody else who's tried to present time in a surreal way.
I've heard David Lynch talk about Kubrick and
mind out.
Microphone's moving on its own. I don't know what's going on. There are ghosts in here.
The lodge.
But he was saying that Stanley Kubrick said that he was watching one of his films. I think he said
on the set of The Shining, Kubrick made them all watch Eraserhead. All of the it cast was Eraserhead. So and said, "This is what I'm going for."
Mm-hmm. But he basically said, this is my favorite film, watch this. And it got back to Lynch and he said, well, once I found out about that, I could die a happy man. So,
Stanley Kubrick thinks my film is the best. Fantastic. Yeah, I could die a happy man knowing that as well.
Because, of course, Kubrick, one of the best directors of all time. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah,
it's my favorite anyway.
Lynch is my favorite, but Kubrick is definitely in my top three. He's absolutely fantastic.
Lynch is downstream of Stanley Kubrick.
I think they're both downstream of one another at some point.
They influenced each other. They were contemporaries, weren't they? Yeah. I was being silly.
Yeah, but that's all very interesting. But to finish off my final bit of the recommendation of Twin Peaks, and I think you'll definitely agree with this, and any red-blooded male in our audience, before we get onto the more
I know where this is going.
Before we get onto the more spoiler-fueled discussion of this, is if you are a fan of beautiful, beautiful women, my God, David Lynch has an eye for him, because he always fills all of his films with beautiful, beautiful women. Twin Peaks alone must have a hottie to notty ratio that puts it above every other place in the entire world. You've got Audrey Horne. You've got Shelley Johnson. You've got Laura Palmer herself. You've got Norma Jennings, played by the beautiful Peggy Lipton, who even at that point, I think they were filming the first series when she was in her 40s. Yeah, still a knockout babe. And then you get in the third series, and then you get him casting someone like Amanda Seyfried as Shelley's daughter. Ah, oh, beautiful. And
you're turning into Lynch.
And the jammy bastard cast himself in a situation in one scene where he gets to make out with one of them.
Isn't it great to be a director, eh? I mean,
wouldn't you?
Wouldn't have been my choice of the beautiful ladies you've listed there, but
who would be yours? Because Shelley is probably my favourite.
It's got to be Audrey, right? I mean, it's the
another excellent choice. Mm-hmm. I won't deny.
It's very much my type, I'm afraid.
Yes, the dark, mysterious type.
That's me in a nutshell.
Very much so. So I think that's a good enough explanation of why it is that you should watch the show.
We ended on a highbrow note there, didn't we?
I think we really did. I think that really cemented for everybody watching that they need to watch it. And from that, I think we should go into more of a discussion about the actual plot of the show and what you think was happening. And this is probably going to center more on the film and the third series, because they're where a lot of the more lasting mysteries go. Because that first two series leaves a lot up to interpretation, but also is structured in a standard enough, almost soap opera way, that it presents a lot of answers as well. So the first mystery that is presented to us, as we mentioned, is who killed Laura Palmer? That's what the whole thing was revolving around. Halfway through the second series, we discover that it was...
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.